Welcome to What Makes Up Your Mind? Updates from the frontiers of neuroscience, well-being, and mental health from the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at Stanford University School of Medicine. This is your invitation to meet the faculty dedicated to understanding our most complex organ, committed to curing mental illness, and inspired to help create a healthier, thriving world. Now, it's good to have you back with us on What Makes Up Your Mind. I'm Jane McMillan. You know, I think I'm pretty safe in guessing that there aren't too many people who aren't anxiously awaiting news of some kind of medical breakthrough, one that would positively alter their life or the life of somebody they love. We know medical research is painstakingly careful, rightfully so. Advancements, boy, they come in hard-won increments. It takes so much time. But take heart, because dedicated researchers are as anxious for answers as we are, and they're using technology to help them speed the process. And now, Stanford Psychiatry is devoting an entirely new initiative to harnessing the vast power of artificial intelligence and machine learning, specifically for the advancement of neuroscience and mental well-being. This new initiative of the chair, Dr. Laura Roberts, is called AI for Mental Health, or AI, the number 4, MH for short. It's a department-wide effort with scientists of every specialty working to develop specific AI tools for their neuro research. Tools that are designed to promote and share breakthroughs, tools that can translate these new answers into more precise diagnoses and better treatments. Now, some of us may not be familiar with AI in the medical arena. In fact, we might be a little leery if we've only encountered it in, say, some pretty convincing but fake imagery online, or shortcut oddities in a document, maybe some eerily predictive advertisements popping up on our phones. No, in medical use, this is a serious and invaluable research tool used within all medical and privacy guidelines. We're going to hear a lot more on that from our guest and why he's convinced machine learning will be a game changer in psychiatric medicine. Dr. Killian Pohl is a professor in psychiatry and behavioral sciences and, by courtesy, electrical engineering at Stanford. With a PhD in computer science from MIT and specializing in machine learning, Dr. Pohl has been working on this intersection of machine learning and how to apply it to the field of neuroscience since 2001. And as the founder of the Computational Neuroscience Laboratory at Stanford, he is one of the leaders of the new AI for Mental Health initiative. He's also incredibly patient in explaining exactly how AI works in his research and how it will be used responsibly for better health outcomes. Dr. Killian Pohl, thanks so much for joining us on What Makes Up Your Mind. So happy to have you here.
Oh, this is fantastic. I'm excited to talk about the work that we do in computational neuroscience and happy to be here.
Thank you. So as I mentioned in the opening, you know, most of us come into contact or have come into contact recently with the idea of machine learning or AI in the news about fake images or how to write a paper faster and with additional help and how do we tell the difference and is it good or is it bad? Let's talk about your view of this. You've been working on this and where it meets neuroscience for so many years. So give a layperson how you see this tool making all of our lives better in the field of medicine and neuroscience in particular.
Yeah, it has been shown that this tool can take complex information and distill it into a form that allows us to improve diagnoses as well as treatment of diseases. Essentially, if we look at where medicine is going, it is acquiring more and more information of a patient. And the amount of information that is acquired is essentially too much for an expert to digest in raw form. So we need to have measurements or markers from all of these complex measurements that we are taking that allow experts to make more precise assessments of the patients, how they're doing. And I think that's where this tool is really powerful.
It's already being used and has been used in other areas of medicine. What do you think has been the gap in using it in terms of mental well-being?
One of the issues is that essentially psychiatry, for example, is a lot based on subjective assessment versus essentially objective measurements about health. And so it's easier to integrate where basically I know what information I can rely on versus what information I have to ignore. And that's where other fields like cancer and cardiology, for example, are, it is easier because they have very precise markers that explain a person's health to a large degree. And in psychiatry, it's much more complex in that sense that we don't have those precise markers. Diseases by itself, depression, for example, it has various symptoms that define the disease. And so it's quite it's a complex undertaking, essentially.
And you are working to close that gap. And do you want to talk about the new initiative that Stanford has coming?
Yeah, so it's called AI for Mental Health. And essentially, what we are trying to do is we are trying to create and develop AI technology specifically for psychiatry so that we can transition from subjective observation to objective precision, resulting in more effective and accessible research and care. And I'm really excited about this because it is an interdisciplinary team, this initiative that consists of clinicians, of people like me that are computer scientists, individuals that are very familiar with ethics, for example. So various expertise come together, and I think that's essential for this to be successful.
Can you talk about the breadth of this new special initiative of the chair? Are there going to be partners around the globe?
First, we are focusing on the department and harnessing the unique abilities that we have within the department. So there's, for example, Dr. Rodriguez, a very established professor in psychiatry that uses large language models to aid in the diagnosis of OCD. We have Dr. Wilsey Sturman, who uses also large language models in clinical practice. And then we have on the other side, for example, Dr. Adeli, who has a joint appointment in computer science and develops technology to better monitor patient and provide more precise diagnoses. So those are just a couple of examples in this group right now.
And I'm sure it will grow.
Yes, it's a department-wide effort, and my computational neuroscience lab is going to be just a part in that initiative. And then we hope once we get our footing that it's going to reach outside the department, have a great impact, and highlight how we are going to make this necessary transition in psychiatry, how we make this possible. Not only innovate technology, but translate it into the clinical setting and also create collaboration across disciplines, AI engineers, medical experts, and educate essentially the clinicians as well as patients about how to reliably use this technology.
Let's move into what happens in your lab, the computational neuroscience lab, and bring it around to how this work is going to impact humans, all of us, because this is what we're all wondering.
Yeah.
What are the advancements? What am I going to see from my clinician? How is this information going to help? So I know that you're working on a few specific scenarios. Would you start with maybe the predictive abilities of AI in your work on substance use?
Yeah. So one of the research projects that has been funded by the National Institute of Health is to predict which adolescents will be at risk or will be most likely heavy users of substances in 1 or 2 years or longer terms, so that we can specifically aid them, tell them about this risk based on their behavior, for example, based on their sleep patterns. and provide them with feedback how they can lower that risk in order to not fall into this trap. Because as we know, heavy substance use, even heavy alcohol use during adolescence, is a major risk factor for alcohol use disorder and all kinds of complications later in life. And it's also a sign, it's often individual uses for self-medication of other psychiatric diseases. And so we can take this more holistic approach in trying to address these problems with the individual.
So this is data that exists.
Yes.
In other studies from other researchers. And this is taking data that already exists. You're not having to run all these tests.
Yeah.
And it's finding new discoveries from this existing data. Do I have that right? Is that kind of AI in a nutshell?
Well, that's AI in a nutshell for me.
But yes,
there are certainly people that acquire data specifically to develop essentially new treatments, new diagnoses. So the project that I'm closely involved with is called the National Consortium on Alcohol and Neurodevelopment in Adolescence, or short, in Canada. And we have been following the same approximately 800 individuals since 2013. And so we, on a yearly basis, follow up with them, getting MRI scans, doing behavioral testing, and also providing self-reports where they can talk about, or give feedback about their current situation. And in between those yearly visits, we check in with them via cell phone apps. So there's different methods. And so we have this finely curated data set that we then look at impact, for example, on drinking behaviors such as things like the COVID pandemic, or we aim to understand better these predictors of unhealthy alcohol drinking. So my collaborators collect that data across the United States, and then we all together analyze the data. This is not the only data set that is out there and available, but there are many other data sets available that make this technology actually possible. So when I started over 20 years ago working on this intersection between machine learning and neuroscience, there wasn't a lot of publicly available data accessible. So a lot of times I had to convince clinicians to give me data, and they said, well, I'll give you data if you can show me that it works. Well, that was kind of a catch 22.
Chicken and egg.
Yes, because I knew how to solve the problem, but I needed data to train these methods, but I wouldn't get the data unless I provided them with a solution. And nowadays that situation is very, very different, thankfully.
Ah, that's good news. That was one of my questions, was accessibility, proprietary information. And we can get into that in a second, but I'd like to stay with this example of your work on predictive substance use in especially young people. What other data might you look to collect to help predict an outcome so that folks can change their behavior? What else would go into it besides, say, family history of drinking? What else would you want to look at?
Yeah, so I mentioned earlier, for example, their sleep pattern is very important. What social circles are they in? How's their academic performance? What is their outlook of life? But also things that are maybe a little bit more subtle, like how anxious are they? Has there been trauma in their life? Those are kind of factors that we can look at. And then we acquire also MRI images in order to better understand kind of underlying mechanisms that lead to this kind of behavior that is not healthy for them.
The other projects that you're working on using these tools, you mentioned you're researching biomarkers for HIV.
Yes.
And that's an international study. First of all, explain what you mean by a biomarker.
Yeah, so we're trying to get essentially biological characteristics that allow us to differentiate individuals, for example, within the HIV populations that suffer from depression versus not, or other mental health diseases. It's also a well-known fact, for example, those with HIV, their brain ages a lot faster. And we're trying to find what is the driving factor behind that so that we can lead to better treatment options for those with HIV.
Your work in brain development and aging is fascinating, and we're all aware of that. We're all aging. We're all on the same treadmill conveyor belt through life, and the United States and in many countries in the world are looking at a massive increase in the number of seniors in their populations. So in looking at brain development, you start very young, but then you look at brain aging all the way through to 90 years of age, and we're talking diseases like Alzheimer's, you know, overall dementia, Parkinson's. I'd love to hear more about that.
Yeah, this is something that partly Dr. Adeli is spearheading in Parkinson's and Alzheimer's disease. The vision is essentially also acquiring data not only in our lab setting, but also in one's individual, wherever they're living, so that we can, for example, point to when there's a change in behavior, we can connect with that patient and say, well, maybe it's time for you to see us again so that we can see how we can adjust treatment. So, for example, if we see that they're falling, okay, that's an indication that they're doing worse or having other problems, that we don't rely on them reporting us so that it gets so severe that it's hard to help them, but find early predictors of the disease.
When you're talking about early, you mentioned that you begin looking at brain development and data starting at 9 years of age. What are some of the markers or data points that you would watch for as children develop into adolescence and then into adults?
Right. So I'm going to talk now a little bit more about kind of basic research setting versus something that's going to work in the clinics. But what we're looking at, for example, is we're acquiring brain MRIs so that we can look at how their structure and function develops. Because we know that around age 25, essentially, I'm just giving here a rough estimate, we're starting to age, okay? So the question is then how that process differs across individuals. And the question is, like, why do some people's brain, for example, age faster, and why do others not? But yeah, I'm looking from that from the perspective of a computer scientist. So I'm trying to extract markers that allow then, you know, expert neuroscientists in the field to better track that process.
Which makes all kinds of sense, especially when we're trying to get ahead of these diseases or treating these diseases.
Yeah.
Using computational science to study something utterly unique like COVID, the impact of COVID. I mean, this is a, we hope, once in a multi-generational event. How does an AI model take a global and unique event like COVID and use that in long-term health studies? How do you use that data, and what data are you looking at, starting with young people?
Right. That's a very good question. So I mentioned earlier the Encanda study where we followed individuals. The study started in 2013, 12 to 21 was their recruitment age. What we acquired were how they were performing with respect to being at risk of depression. We noticed that was pretty stable throughout the years, but once COVID hit at the start of the pandemic, their risk of depression suddenly tripled. It was a disruption in terms of this mental health marker. And so when we are now looking at using this data within the machine learning setting, we have to distinguish the data that was acquired before COVID versus after COVID because of the effect that event had on many of our individuals in the study. And so we are currently further investigating exactly that point, which measurements and which kind of markers kept on being stable and which ones really fluctuated when we compared before and after COVID. So we have to take those into account because it changed a lot of people's life, the pandemic, and we have to model within the machine learning approach.
Are you already gathering some conclusions as you are going along in terms of the impact of COVID on this generation, the young people who were adolescents and teens?
What we can see is that the risk of depression, at least in our cohort, is not as high anymore as it was right after the pandemic, but is also not back to the level where it was pre-COVID. Generally, in terms of mental health, the younger generation, the studies that I read, the scores, the mental health is not as good as it was before COVID. There's a lot of struggling in that generation.
What data points, for example, so I can kind of wrap my head around what would go into giving you this kind of general conclusion at this point? So would you look at what continuation of schooling? Would you look at other health issues? Or
we're looking at their questionnaires. They're standard questionnaires that I ask things like, how do you feel? You know, just a simple question. And every year we ask these individuals these questions and we just see how they are changing their answers throughout the years. That is one way of measuring. So this it's self-reported in a sense.
Okay. And you mentioned a moment ago that your work currently is gathering and assessing, looking at what AI can do in terms of predicting and prevention. And you said it doesn't yet impact what goes on in a clinician's office, but that's what you see in the future.
Right. So what I've hinted on before, and there are many issues to solve, but what I see going to happen is when I go to the doctor or when I participate in prevention programs, you know, we carry our phones with us. We carry so many tools with us that can acquire data about us outside the doctor's office. And that essentially we are going to come, not only us, but all of this data that is passively acquired of us to the doctor. They're going to get a more complete picture of us and going to get a very specific report that allows them to do a precise diagnosis of really what's going on with us. And then because we are not just assessing then the patient inside the clinic, but also in their home setting, we are able to intervene with them on a more continuous basis. And we are also be able to specialize treatment and training programs specifically to the need of the patient. That's what I'm seeing, what I'm predicting is going to happen in the future. Essentially, a more holistic approach to treating mental diseases.
When you talk about passive collecting of data, and you're right, people have Fitbits and smart homes and their cell phones, and who knows what we'll have in the near future, that can be a little concerning to folks. You know, what's being collected? Who's getting to see it? How do you, as a scientist that sees so much potential in this, also see how those fears might be assuaged? Or often technology's abilities jump way ahead of society's ability to either monitor or put in safeguards. So how do you, who is such a proponent of this technology, see all that coming together?
I echo your concern, and I think it is really, really important. And this is something that has to be discussed within the society. This is a new tool that has possibilities, new possibilities of improving our health, but there are also risks associated, right? There's risk about our privacy. That's why it is important that different experts in different domains discuss this topic with each other in terms of, for example, ethics of how to use the data and making sure there is not a breach of confidentiality. Already now, there are barriers that make sure the patient information is safeguarded. And what happens when there is a violation of that safeguarding There are procedures in place within Stanford, for example, that ensure that the privacy of patients are preserved. But this is a bigger question that's beyond, you know, my specific expertise, that also requires people and policy to be integrated into this discussion, because it's a very important one. How much of our individual personal information do we want to give up to gain the possible improvement in treating these diseases? And there are many factors to be considered in this equation.
Oh, certainly. And folks are looking at this incredible potential through the lens of what we're dealing with now, with insurance and pre-existing conditions and government information. But you make the case for plowing forward and being very mindful of both.
Well, and there needs to be technology, as there's technology developed, for example, by me, that is predicting future onset of diseases. There needs to be also technology developed to safeguard information. It goes hand in hand.
I'd like to jump back into a clinician's office. And I know you are not a clinician, you are a researcher. But if we're talking about all of this incredible data and the predictive abilities of AI in medicine, and we're in a psychiatrist's or a psychologist's office with a patient, I can see how a patient would feel very confident if they were going to see a cardiologist or what we might consider a physical ailment, about a physical ailment, and that all of this quantitative information is there to help, help treat them, help pinpoint. But, you know, when we go into talk about our emotional well-being, I know mind and body are the same, but in mental wellness or illness, it's about how we, often how we emotionally feel. And I could see somebody listening say, how does that translate into AI, quantitative AI information from my therapist?
I talked a little bit about how we can collect information already outside the doctor's office and how that could be integrated into a report. But even if you are sitting in the doctor's office, the doctor might focus on a specific disease. For example, you come and we mentioned Alzheimer's disease earlier. You're coming in the office because you're suffering from Alzheimer's disease and the clinician is diagnosing you for that. But there might be also secondary diseases that you are suffering from, for example, depression, that could be easily overlooked, but really impact care for you. And I think this is where AI can help, not only generating reports, but also providing kind of a secondary, kind of, again, passively monitoring your responses and pointing out that this individual might be also suffering from other diseases, and that might be a good idea to check up on that patient with respect to, for example, depression. And that's where I see a lot of benefit of this technology. A lot of benefit of this technology is also that specific markers that we have are kind of subjective, right? We see how somebody is performing a certain task, and then the expert is going to rate them, let's say, from 1 to 6. And that's, again, where AI could help us automatically rating the individual's ability to perform the task, so that then the clinician, for example, doesn't have to spend time on that task, gets a more maybe refined measurement about the individual. It's not only 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, but maybe a 2.3. And here is another issue that we are discovering while they performed this task, and allows the clinician essentially more effectively to diagnose and treat the individual.
That made me think, when you were describing that tasking, it made me think of movement, the ability to assess human movement related to neurological diseases. You know, we hate the idea of fake imagery using AI in the public sphere, but there's a place for synthetic imaging through this technology in treatment of or diagnosis of diseases that we can see manifesting in the human brain.
Yeah. This machine learning technology needs a lot of data to train. And unlike, for example, if we are looking at natural images or if we are looking at text, medical images are very expensive to acquire and therefore are small in size. You know, we need to invite patients, get them into an MRI scanner, take the images, and then analyze those MRIs. So these studies are generally in small in size, where the technology requires a large number of images to be properly trained. So actually, one of the things that we are in the process of developing is to artificially generate MRIs so that we can diversify these data sets, make them larger, and then allow them to train this machine learning technology. What we can also then do, possibly in the future with that, is show how somebody's brain will develop, where we predict how their brain is going to be in the future if they continue with the lifestyle as is, and can show them if they change their lifestyle, how their brain would look differently, hopefully more healthy. This is going to be very useful for prevention efforts. We could also use this way of synthetically creating MRIs for treatment planning, and look at, depending on how the treatment is performed, how then the brain is developing 6 months from now, for example. So these are topics that we are working on, and that's what these artificial, for example, MRIs could be very useful for. Another part, often when we perform longitudinal studies, an MRI, a certain MRI is missing at a specific age, but it's necessary to really reliably perform the analysis. And so we could synthetically estimate how the MRI would look in order to do a more precise analysis of one person's brain development.
So it can fill in the gaps in between a baseline MRI and, say, an advanced disease MRI.
Yeah, exactly. Or you acquired your MRI at a specific site, but you're going now to a different clinic that is used to seeing those MRIs in a different image resolution or a different orientation or in a different modality, and it could estimate how that MRI is going to look.
And MRIs are expensive, so if you can accurately and synthetically produce these images for prevention and research information, that must be helpful.
Yes, it's going to not eradicate doing so, but it will allow us maybe to reduce costs, because we will be able to, for example, acquire MRIs at higher resolution in a much smaller amount of time. Or we need, for example, less number of MRIs acquired of an individual to come to more robust conclusions about how the individual is developing.
Talking about funding, does your funding come from the federal government? Is it privately funded through philanthropy? And is it hard to make the case for something that is very futuristic in a sense?
Me personally, I've been doing my research for the last 20 years, mostly entirely funded by the NIH. I received a little bit of money from philanthropy, but I would say 90% of my research is funded by the NIH. Other funding sources are philanthropy and possibly industry, but until recently, machine learning and AI was not a very sexy topic, so it kind of was more seen as something that was, as you say, very futuristic, and the potential benefit weren't as clear. And so I've been very thankful for the vision of the NIH to support such work that is really in the intersection of computer and neuroscience.
Well, let's finish up with your pitch for continued support and make it sexy. What we can look forward to with the support of this work, how it's going to help our lives.
You know, we've seen AI transform entire industries, and really we envision, you know, partly by this new initiatives, AI for mental health, that this technology will shift psychiatry from kind of subjective observations to objective precision, resulting really in more effective and accessible research and care. And that is needed because mental health, sadly enough, currently in the US society is on a decline. And there are only so many trained physicians available within the United States. So if we want to make progress in this domain, we have to rely on technology that can really account for the complexity of these mental diseases. And we believe AI can account for that and help really the clinicians to make a better diagnosis of these diseases. So that's kind of my short pitch of it.
Perfect and sexy. Dr. Killian Pohl, thank you so much for your time and for telling us about the new initiative. And we'd like to keep in touch with you and your partners and get updates as we go along.
Thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to talk. Thank you.
Our pleasure. Dr. Killian Pohl, professor in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences and by courtesy Electrical Engineering at Stanford University, founder of the Computational Neuroscience Lab and a key contributor to the department's new initiative of the chair, AI for Mental Health. And we have links to Dr. Pohl's work and to the AI for Mental Health initiative in our program notes. And as Dr. Pohl said, many Stanford psychiatry researchers and clinicians are participating in this initiative, and we're going to be exploring their work. So check back for more on What Makes Up Your Mind. Thank you for joining us. I'm Jane McMillan. You've been listening to What Makes Up Your Mind? Updates from the frontiers of neuroscience, well-being, and mental health, from the experts in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at Stanford University School of Medicine. For more information on this program and all of our transformational work, visit us at med.stanford.edu/psychiatry. What Makes Up Your Mind? Updates from the frontiers of neuroscience, well-being, and mental health is a production of the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at Stanford University School of Medicine, a copyright of the Board of Trustees of Stanford University.